Mr. Hale. Before you begin, I'd like to thank all counsel for accommodating our schedule today. We don't often meet in the afternoon, so thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity to have you listen to us, Your Honor. I think I can say that for all parties. If I may begin. We have two reasons that immunity is appropriate here, and they're independently sufficient. One is money, and the other is agency. We know from the PRPA decision that satisfying a judgment out of state funds is a sufficient but not a necessary condition for 11th Amendment immunity. The Tidelands Trust revenues here are held in the Port Revenue Fund, and they are to be treated as state, not city assets, and therefore the judgment would be satisfied from state funds.
California Attorney General doesn't seem to agree with that.
Well,
she says you're on your own.
My reading of the State Attorney General's brief is that she said that any judgment has to be satisfied out of the Port Revenue Fund. And so then the question is, are those state funds or are they city funds for purposes of 11th Amendment immunity?
Well, I'm not so sure that that's right. The here's what I've got, what she said here. Until the legislature acts to revoke the grant or to revoke the public trust over the fund, the Port Revenue Fund, the Port Revenue Fund and all liability for port-incurred debts resides with the port, all liability.
Yes.
And they're not about to revoke, or they haven't revoked it. They don't seem to be about to revoke the public trust.
Right. And so then the question, Your Honor, is does that what funds does that liability attach to? There's
Port Revenue Fund.
I'm sorry?
You said Port Revenue
Yes.
Fund.
And so then the which brings us back, and I'm not trying to be circular here, but it brings us back to the question of, are the monies in the Port Revenue Fund state funds or city funds for 11th Amendment immunity purposes? We don't disagree with her position that this doesn't come out of the state treasury, but I don't think that's...
Well, isn't the impact on the state fisc a key question here?
Well, the
I thought you said it was.
I'm sorry?
I thought you said it was, actually.
Yes, yeah. I did. And the question is this part of the state fisc? Are these state assets for purposes of 11th Amendment immunity? We know that the money in the Port Revenue Fund is segregated. It is held in trust. It is not usable by the city for any municipal purposes. It is generated solely by operation of the Tidelands. And so the city has this separate fund here. I don't know that anyone's claiming that the city itself is liable as opposed to the immunity, to the Port Revenue Fund.
So what is the fund ordinarily used for?
The fund is used for the operations of the port, and it is used for paying back the bonds that were floated, which are not, no liability goes to the city of Oakland for. Those bonds were floated for the purpose of building the marine facilities that are at issue.
Are those bonds guaranteed by the state?
They are guaranteed only by the revenue of the port's operation, so not by the city, not by the state.
So the funds that you generate from operation of the port are used solely for the operation of the port?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet you say they're state funds.
I say that for 11th Amendment immunity purposes, they are deemed funds funds of the state, yes.
I can see how you might say that with some authority in terms of the state constitution as to whether they're public monies. How did you connect it to the 11th Amendment?
Well, I think that the way to get there is to take a brief tour through two decisions of the California Supreme Court that I think give the meaning to the state character of these funds. The first is the Morse decision, where the city of Long Beach had tried to appropriate these monies for its own purposes, for municipal uses, and the California State Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. This is not your money.
Yeah, but isn't it, that's because they were dedicated to the, as with the case of the port, the proceeds are dedicated, restricted to the operation of the port.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes. And so then
that's just a question of what the restriction that was imposed upon the use of the funds from the outset, right?
Yes.
I don't see how that makes them state funds. It says there's a restriction. It was with you since 1911, I think.
Yes.
And this violated the limitation that was imposed.
Well, let me run through the two cases, and I hope I can convince Your Honor that I'm in fact right. Basically, in the Morse case, the California Supreme Court said that there's no distinction between the character of the funds and the city's ability to take those funds and the underlying Tidelands, which generated those funds. We have the same situation here. If you look And the court also said that whatever right the city had or might have, might claim to those trust assets are derivative of the state's sovereign trust, and the city holds those lands subject to the same trust. A couple years later, in the Mallon case, Long Beach was again in front of the California Supreme Court trying to get its hands on the Tidelands revenues, and the city of Long Beach had convinced the state legislature to adopt a law partially revoking or terminating the trust as to certain monies, certain excess monies, and tried to then provide those monies to the city for city purposes. Again, the California Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That's not your money. Tidelands revenues are state funds, and you can't
give those. Well, they're state funds in terms of whether it would be a violation of the state constitution, right, to, whether it would constitute a gift of public funds.
Right.
That, again, I ask you how you tie that to the 11th Amendment. That's a state constitutional interpretation.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that they have to be either state. I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't want to interrupt. State funds or city funds. And it's pretty clear that they're not city funds. So then the question is, are they state funds for purposes of 11th Amendment immunity? We know they have the same character as the underlying Tidelands. And we also know that from the Coeur d'Alene case, that there is a unique sovereignty that is tied to these sovereign Tidelands. It's of constitutional dimension. It's beyond just the power of the federal government to regulate. The phrase that they used were uniquely sovereign interests under a body of law dating back to the Magna Carta. So if you take Mallon, Morse, and Coeur d'Alene together, you have a couple of principles. The first is that the sovereign that the Tidelands have a unique sovereign character that is a statewide interest, it's not a local interest. The second is that the port revenue funds themselves are generated from this sovereign land. And the third is that the city has no right to use that money for city purposes. It is only to be used for state purposes. The new California statute that was passed during the pendency of this litigation says that this is a statewide purpose, and in essence, the conclusion from that is that these funds are only to be used for a state, not a local purpose, and therefore they're to be treated for sovereign immunity purposes with the same degree of sovereignty as the underlying Tidelands.
But that, I don't, that still doesn't seem to get you where you need to be, because as you were saying, the cases that you're looking at, one of the things that happened that the city needed to happen in order to try to use this money was to revoke the public trust, correct? And so it seems to me that to say that it's public money doesn't mean that it's money out of the state treasury unless the state has in fact done that.
Well, the question embedded in that, I think, is does the money have to be in the state treasury or can it be imbued with state sovereignty in some other way, being an asset of the state? And I don't think anyone would argue that these lands could be seized by a judgment creditor. I think the state's immunity to the lands would go along with that. I think the same principle ought to apply to the revenue that's derived from the operation of these lands under the Morse case, if I've answered your honor's question.
I think that's true, but the Supreme Court has always looked at 11th Amendment immunity fairly narrowly in terms of whether it's the state's money that's at risk.
Well, the question, I think, is, though, I don't think the Supreme Court has dealt with this particular issue.
No, that's true.
And so I think you have to look to state law for the characterization of the funds under the Doe case. And as a result of that, I think we go back to Morse and we say, well, is there any difference between the Tidelands and the money generated from the Tidelands? And I think the answer to that is no. For sovereignty purposes, they're dealt with the same, at least under state law. And I think that is the question that is to be resolved here. Let me turn then briefly to my other argument, which is, as we said, independently sufficient, and that is the question of whether the port is acting as an agent trustee for the state in administering the Tidelands Trust here. The basic claim that this action rests on is that the port's action in administering the Tidelands Trust, in executing an allegedly unfair lease for one of intervener's competitors, violated the Shipping Act. And under PRPA, at least according to our reading of PRPA, and I think the government may not entirely disagree with this, agents of the state acting within the scope of that agency under a functional analysis are immune. The Supreme Court in the McMillan case phrased the question as follows. We simply ask if Sheriff Tate represents the state or the county when he acts as a policymaker. So the question here is, was the port acting as agent trustee, or put in the terms of McMillan, representing the state when it acted here? We have three statements, if you will, or three sources of law that have been provided to us by the state during the pendency of this litigation. The first is, in September 2010, the state legislature enacted a new section of the Public Resources Code, which said that the state has the absolute right and power to control the tidelands when acting within the scope of its public trust. It also provided that the tidelands granted to the port remain subject to the public trust and the oversight authority of the state by and through the State Lands Commission. And third, the port must always act in accordance with the public trust without subordination to local or municipal affairs. This is back to their acting as an agent of the state for a state purpose. The purposes, according to this new legislation, which was declaring existing law, this is section 6009E, the purposes and use of the tidelands are a statewide concern, not a local concern. Second, we had a letter from an opinion letter, not sure quite exactly what characterization we give to it, but it's a pronouncement from the chief counsel of the State Lands Commission saying that, describing first the State Lands Commission's responsibility, its obligation to oversee the management of sovereign trust lands and grantees, such as the port, report to the State Lands Commission. In administering the public trust, the Tidelands Trust, the port performs, in the words of the State Lands Commission, a valuable governmental function on behalf of the state, and as such should be considered as acting as an arm of the state. We've had some discussion in the briefs about the authority of that. I think it's at least entitled to Skidmore deference as a statement of the agency which is responsible for the state's day-to-day oversight of the Tidelands Trust. Third, we have, as Justice Ginsburg points out, the State Attorney General's brief, and they were asked for a description by the Federal Maritime Commission of the impact of public trust, the public trust doctrine under California law. She confirmed that the State Lands Commission is the entity that has day-to-day supervisorial responsibility over entities such as the port. She confirmed that the State Lands Commission functions as the legislature's day-to-day eyes and ears with respect to the oversight of the granted sovereign public trust lands. She stated that, and this is her view and her statement, that the commission's staff is in frequent contact with the port, and she described an ongoing relationship that looks like and talks like and walks like the relationship between a principal and an agent. She also described the 23 separate times that the state legislature has amended the statute governing the port to micromanage issues like how long can the port lease a facility for? Is it 50 years or 60 years or 66 years?
23 times over how long?
Since 1911.
So 102 years.
Yes.
So once that's, every 4 years, years.
Yes.
Or so, the state has something to say.
Yes, Your Honor.
And is legislation the only way by which they can require or direct the port to do anything?
Oh, that's what the State Lands Commission is there for. The State Lands Commission works with the port.
Do you have any indication that the State Lands Commission does anything along these lines?
We have the statement of the Attorney General in her brief that the State Lands Commission is responsible for day-to-day oversight.
I understand that, but what does that mean? Are there any day-to-day activities? Any indication in the record of what, if anything, they do?
Yes, their responsibility is to tell the trustee when they're within and without the scope of the trust.
Well, that's their responsibility. Are there any transactions, any evidence they actually do anything?
Beyond the evidence.
Just the legal framework, I understand.
Right. We have the evidence in the record from the State Attorney General's brief. That's
which is none, again recounts no actual direction from the SLC. The legislature is on record. We see that.
Yes.
All right. But that's all we've got.
Right. Well, that's all we have in the record on this issue. We have the authority and the statement of the State Lands Commission itself, as to its relationship.
The SLC monitors the operation of the port, but if they decided that you were doing something that of which they disapproved, could they tell you to do something differently, or would it require some other intervention?
They can and do. I suppose that the natural question that follows up from that is, what if we disobey them?
That's right. If you say no, then do they have any recourse other than legislation? Or
it's like any agent-principal relationship. If the agent disobeys the principal can either revoke the agency, which the state can do, or they can take the agent to court and make them comply. I mean, we don't have the ability to armed force use. It's a question of, if they don't comply with what the agency, the State Lands Commission, tells them to do, then the State Lands Commission has to escalate. But that's no different than any other agent in principle.
Doesn't the fact that they would have to escalate to litigation or legislation suggest that you're not an arm or agent of the state in the sense that we would be describing here, because that would, you know, assume that there would be nothing between you and the state?
I think not, Your Honor, and I'll explain why. Any agent that disobeys a principal and runs off with the principal's money, you have the same recourse there. So I don't think that the fact that they have to resort to litigation is a per se bar against the agent-principal relationship applying here. It's at most an issue that might, we have a series of balancing factors, and you look at the factors on this side and you look at the factors on this side, and the factors on the side of agency I think weigh higher and heavier than the factors on the side of non-agency. Anything being done here by the city, by the Port Authority, has to be done consistent with the dictates of the state. I've run into my time, and I'd like to save a minute and a half for rebuttal if I may here.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wood?
May it please the court, Tyler Wood on behalf of the respondents. Oakland asks this court to take sovereign immunity someplace it has never been in the United States Supreme Court. For more than 120 years, the Supreme Court has inflexibly refused to extend sovereign immunity to counties and municipalities, even when they are operating portions of state power, as Oakland here claims. This court should deny the petition for three main reasons. First, the state did not intend to create a relationship that would confer immunity. Second, the state does not control the port for purposes of immunity, or the city of Oakland for purposes of immunity. And third, the funds at issue are not, in fact, state funds. First, the 1911 grant is the best indicator of what the state intended. The grant itself looked like a fee simple grant of lands to the city of Oakland. Oakland possessed at that time all right, title, and interest in the lands, subject to this broad doctrine of use, as Judge Ginsburg noted. As long as the operation of the port and the money that comes in pursuant to those operations goes back into the lands itself, we know that there's no problem, and that's precisely what the state intended. A helpful comparison here is San Francisco. Literally on the other side of the bay, the state itself controlled, the governor appointed at that time, all five members of the San Francisco State Board of Harbor Commissioners, and the governor himself could remove those people. So we know that in 1911, the state of California well knew how to create an actual arm of the state or an agency relationship that would create immunity. Also, Lake Country Estates instructs us that you must have good reason to believe that the state structured the agency to enjoy immunity or the relationship to enjoy immunity. And as this court said in Morris versus WMATA, the intention to confer immunity must be manifest. Here, what we have originally in 1911 was fee simple conveyance with the addition of a few limitations on how the lands can be used. Next, the state does not control Oakland for purposes of immunity. And according to Puerto Rico Ports Authority, this court said that inquiry necessarily looks at how directors and officers are appointed. Here, the Oakland Port Board is appointed by the mayor. It's removable by the city council. They're confirmed by the city council. The quickest way to effect change in what Oakland does with its port is either for referendum, which involves only the citizens of Oakland, or the mayor could conceivably remove with the, I think, 6-8 vote of the City Council of Oakland. If the state wished to change the operations of the port, it would have to either change the law, as we've noted, or it would have to convince the State Lands Commission or some other entity to go into court. So it would have to hail the city into court to effect change. If that's control, it's a very inefficient kind of control, and it's not a kind of control that the Supreme Court has ever recognized. In fact, this court and in Puerto Rico Ports Authority and the Supreme Court in Lake Country Estates said a resort to litigation does not indicate control. In fact, that demonstrates a lack of control, that if you have to have a judge agree with you in demonstrating that something is going wrong.
Is there any record of litigation here?
We're aware of one district court case where the state of California and a myriad of plaintiffs hailed the city and the port into court involving wetlands. It's in our brief. I don't know that it was finally resolved on that issue, but the point being that the city has to be hailed into court or...
What's the case name?
The case name is, I believe, California versus City of Oakland that we've styled. We can point it out in our brief. It was an issue involving wetlands. The federal government was also a plaintiff, if my memory serves.
California versus Marsh?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Marsh being sort of like wetlands?
I beg your pardon?
No.
Marsh being sort of like wetlands?
Right. It was a watershed case, for lack of a better term. Pardon the pun.
I just turned.
Again, with respect to control, we know the mayor appoints the board, even though...
I don't know how material that is. The sheriff was elected locally, right, in the Supreme Court case.
The sheriff was in the...
He was a state law enforcement officer.
Correct, because even though he was elected locally, so the local people chose who would be the sheriff, the sheriff in Alabama reports to the attorney general and to the governor for direction on law enforcement. So even though...
You're saying, you know, the local people may, political process may choose the governors of the port, but the port responds to the State Lands Commission.
Well, they don't respond to the State Lands Commission in direct control.
What did you make of the daily ears and eyes statement?
Well, eyes and ears isn't enough. To be a watchdog is not enough.
You have to have a good nose.
You would have to have a good nose.
As well as eyes and ears. So eyes and ears are not enough. You have to be...
You have to have day-to-day control in the sense that you are directing the actions. Like the instruction would have to be, for 11th Amendment purposes, you should buy this gantry crane in order to offload more things.
Any indication that that's what happened with the sheriff?
There is the indication that the sheriff responded to the governor and the attorney general in how, in which laws to focus enforcement, and also the sheriff in Alabama reported to the judges who were state officials. Everyone acknowledged that they were state officials, and also reported to judges in different districts. So,
well, but surely reporting to or being responsible to judges from around the state doesn't look at all like day-to-day control, right? Judges don't ordinarily tell policemen what to do.
Judges don't, but the attorney general might, the district attorney might, in instructing how to charge certain things. So there, in addition to the Alabama sheriff being listed as an executive in the Alabama Constitution, you have the report to a number of recognized state officials on where they received instruction. Moreover, I think that on the day-to-day control, just accounting also wouldn't equal day-to-day control, as the First Circuit said in Fresenius, and which was cited heavily by this court in Puerto Rico Ports Authority. Imposing fiscal discipline alone is not enough. So just requiring a local municipality to submit budget documents or financial documents is not alone enough to indicate the kind of control that would impugn the state's dignity for purposes of the 11th Amendment. And we also know from Hess versus Port Authority Trans-Hudson, ultimate residual control of a state is not enough. That just because a state can undo what it has previously done merely describes the relationship of the state as the superior entity and the relationship with the municipality or any entity that it creates. So we know, too, that ultimate residual control is not enough for purposes of the 11th Amendment. Finally, the funds at issue are not, in fact, state funds. As the California Attorney General noted, until revocation, all obligations and choices that are to be made with the funds remain with the city itself and its port board. The state would not be obligated to pay this judgment, and we have no indication that they would be responsible for other judgments. To the contrary, the Attorney General has indicated that the state is on its own, as Judge Ginsburg noted. The state can't direct where a given dollar must go. It can't make those kinds of directions on investing in gantry cranes or dredging a harbor. In order to prevent spending, the state must hail the city into court. And if these were, in fact, state funds, they would simply issue a directive, the governor, state lands commission, or whomever, telling the port where to invest a given dollar. But we know that they don't have that ability in this case. Finally, the public trust is a doctrine of use. As long as the city complies with this broad use, and as long as dollars are going back into some arguable purpose related to the port, the state does not have an interest in directing where the money must go. So the state cannot decide how a given dollar must be spent and can only challenge when it disagrees with an investment and go to court or change the law. And the fact that we've had these changes, 23 changes over a period of 100 plus years, indicates that the state doesn't in fact control these dollars and how they're spent. If it did, it wouldn't have to change the law. For example, when Long Beach and Los Angeles found oil resources in the harbors, they could have simply said, give the money to the state if they actually controlled the money. Instead, they had to change the law and direct that the money, instead of going back into the public trust use pursuant to Morse, it instead went to the state. So we have a clear delineation there of, if we cannot control the resources that come out of it, we will segregate those from traditional public trust, and that money must go back into the state treasury. That hasn't happened with Oakland with respect to the way dollars are spent. We've had this general reservation about oil resources and natural resources, but again, that demonstrates that the state at that time did not believe that it could control where those revenues were going, other than the indication from Morse that the money had to go back into the public trust lands. Another point brought up by my colleague, the port has apparently issued bonds that they've pledged the assets of this port revenue fund to pay off the bonds. And it's a unique position to say that, well, we can't pay a judgment out of this, but we can pledge the asset to other creditors. So the point there is that if these were truly state funds, you would have a problem pledging the assets of the state.
Well, there are revenue bonds.
There are revenue bonds. And
so the corpus isn't pledged.
Exactly, and it's precisely our point, that as long as the use of the funds goes back into the operation of the port, you are fine with the public trust doctrine. And as long as it's related to commerce, navigation, and fishing, the use complies with public trust, and you are not transferring quote-unquote state funds to local municipal purposes.
Not sure I see the relevance of the bond indebtedness for that.
Well, the relevance is that if you can pledge state assets, which they claim that they can't do as part of the corpus, this corpus belongs to the state. If it truly belonged to the state and they couldn't pledge things that belong to the state, then they couldn't pledge this asset stream coming in pursuant to the operation of the port in order to satisfy creditors that aren't the state. Is the point. Then they also have the ability to create bonds that not only pledge the assets of the Port Revenue Fund, but also the City of Oakland. So there, again, the state is not on the hook for any judgment that would come out of this, even if they use bonds to fulfill that. And if there are no...
You're saying they do have the authority to issue general obligation bonds?
In the charter, it does appear that they have the ability to do that. I don't believe there's anything in the record to indicate that they have, or that even that they would, but the ability does exist in the city charter and the operation of the port. Hmm. And if there are no other questions, I'll yield my time.
All right. Does Mr. Hillman have any time? Why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thank you, appreciate it. Be quick. First, on the bond question, I think the answer is that states issue bonds all the time, so that doesn't necessarily impair their sovereign immunity. I don't read the city charter the same way as my distinguished colleague does. I don't think that the port can issue general obligation bonds against the city. Specifically, there's language in the charter on that. One point I'd like to make about the McMillan case and this whole local versus state issue is that under the California Constitution, in the two sections that we cited in our brief, Article 11, Section 5, and Article 13B, there are significant constraints imposed on the ability of the state legislature to tell cities what to do on municipal affairs. Those constraints don't exist here with respect to the state's ability to tell the port what to do. Second, we have this issue of the port's oversight, excuse me, the city's oversight of the port and the fact that there's some local appointment, which I believe Judge Ginsburg pointed out is no different than at McMillan, where you can the local government can vote in or vote out the sheriff. And so it's back to a question of who are they representing when they're performing this particular function. And the one last point I'd like to make is this issue of the constrainingness of the Tidelands Public Trust Doctrine and the Tidelands Trust Doctrine. I think it does constrain the port's operations considerably. The state had to pass legislation for such things as telling the port that they could use certain funds without a recompense to create a highway. And that's precisely the kind of thing that they can tell them, okay, well, here you can vary from we're making a decision on the public trust issue, and so we'll give you this particular bit of legislation. And the final point I'd like to make is that the Mallon decision, again, says that the state has the control here. And that's on page 210, I believe it is, of the Mallon decision. And with that, I yield the non-existent balance of my time.
Thank you.